Welcome to the age stage. Hi. And welcome, Brody.
Hello.
How are you?
You're looking very svelte today.
Oh, well, I do like that compliment.
Yes.
I do like that compliment.
I like the coat. I like the jacket.
Oh, it's radio, Brody. No one can see what coat I've got on, unfortunately. But would you believe it's show number 5?
No. No, I would not.
Well, I only believe it because it's written down. But it's gone pretty fast, hasn't it?
It has. And it's been great fun so far.
It has been lots of fun. But I think why it's so fun is because we have some great guests on.
We do.
We do. And we've done it again. This week we have Tom Camp back again.
Yes.
He likes visiting us, I think.
Although we might lose him next week.
I think so.
So we'll have to make the best of him this week.
We will. We'll make the most of it. And Stuart Shaw is back with us as well.
Yay. And he's going away too. So this is
Everyone's going away. But
so we're all going walkabout.
We'll be chatting to them whilst we can then, won't we?
So we might get Kim back.
We may get Kim back.
When Stuart goes on his trip.
That's true. That's true. So they'll be speaking to us again about retirement village life.
Yep.
And you know, how to get to that sort of lifestyle and some very important changes that are coming up within that sector. So they'll be informing us about those.
And after them?
After them, we have Tricia Hill from Life Solutions, and she'll be chatting to us about the difference between an accountant and a financial planner. Because sometimes they get thrown in together, but they're very different. And so she's going to explain to us the ins and outs and when we should be looking at each. And we've also got Samantha Dickerson back.
Yes, she is. That's good.
Yeah, so she's talking about cremation myths.
Yes, there's a lot of stuff in there that people are frightened to ask more than anything else.
Well, I probably wouldn't know much.
Happens to a hip that's been replaced and that sort of stuff.
Oh, yes. See, there you go. I never would have thought of those
bits. Does it actually burn, Brody?
Shh. You're not on yet. Quiet.
And then we've got Adam Ford.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he's talking to us about European cruising, which is going to be excellent. Something I can't afford to do, I'm sure.
I've never done one myself.
No, nor have
but
I.
The ads look very nice.
We're going to have to live vicariously through his stories.
I'll be looking forward to listening.
Well, in the meantime, let's play the important signature music for our two super guests. And welcome.
Welcome, Stuart and Tom.
Good to see
How's
you,
going?
Stuart.
Good to see you, Brody.
Thomas.
Vicky. Nice to be back. Thomas, that's what my mother used to call me.
Oh, so. When you were a naughty boy, I'm
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Do you want a quick fishing story?
It happened really regularly, I can tell you, Vicky.
Somehow I imagine
story?
That true.
Tell me about your fishing story, Brody.
My grandson has just come back from overseas.
Fantastic.
He's 10.
Yes.
He went out on a boat,
yep.
Caught a 150-pound black marlin, blue marlin, black marlin.
That's What's fantastic. That in kilograms,
Not bad,
guys?
Eh? He cannot stop talking about it.
We were hoping you were able to convert that thing.
I can't convert, I'm sorry.
What, about black marlin?
No, the weight,
oh,
the size of the fish. Is it as big as a person?
It's bigger than him. Yeah, yes, absolutely. Well, it would be as big as me.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
That's a big marlin, guys.
That's a serious fish.
And he
150
did,
kilos.
Yeah, and he didn't. And he,
you're that big.
Yeah, and a bit. No, not quite. Let's get on. We've got important things to discuss.
We do. So last week when Kim was here with you, Tom, we were talking about aged care and how a lot of terminology just all sounds the same. We sort of pile it all in together, whether it's a nursing home, it's aged care, et cetera, or retirement village. But they are very different,
correct,
as we were discussing last week. So what is a retirement village?
The definition.
Well, actually, I've become very prepared today
because
Stuart and I
this.
Want to sound so intelligent. So this is actually an excerpt out of the Retirement Village Act. But just to
My heavens.
My heavens. That's pretty good, isn't it, Stuart? Now, look, the inference is there's a lot of terminology used. And if you notice last week when Kim was talking about aged care and we heard about RADs and DABs and all the different...
All those acronyms.
Acronyms and things like that and all the... checks you have to go through, financial, health and so on, ACAT and SACS and all of that sort of thing. And it's just important people get familiar with those. You don't want to shy away from them, but those are specific and related to the aged care. And if you remember last week, we talked about the fact that it was federal legislation.
Yes.
And federally regulated and quite tight. So we thought today, to answer your question, is to begin to familiarise yourself with some of the terminology that's used in retirement villages and the Retirement Village Act. So your question is a very good one, Brody. This is the determination of what a retirement village is under the Retirement Village 1986 Act.
86.
Well prepared, Stewie. Right. There's a whole lot of amendments and regulation that's come since then, but it's pretty cool. So a retirement village means a community, the majority of which is retired persons who are provided with accommodation and services other than services that are provided in a residential care facility, and at least one of whom, this is the retirees that live in it, before or upon becoming a member of that community, pays or is required to pay an ingoing contribution. Okay, so there's a big term, ingoing contribution, and right. that is a major term that determines whether a village or a facility actually is a retirement village. I'm going to throw to Stewie.
And there's no age in there or anything like that. It's just...
It's predominantly retired.
Retired.
People. If this 55 age is... actually, Stu, you can probably cover this, but it's really a 19th century paradigm because of, in the old days when our parents were working, they would probably work in one job for 30 years, a whole career, particularly in the public service,
yes.
get their gold watch and go. And the age of 55 it was the first legitimate age that you could retire, particularly under superannuation law. And that's what a lot of public servants used to take what was called a 5411 pension. And that's where the whole idea of 55 moving into retirement actually became enshrined in legislation. Right. Now, as we know, our society is changing. Superannuation law now is, and certainly accumulation up to the age of 75. We've got a lot of people still working well beyond, you know, the pension ages of 65
yes,
and 67 now. So,
and funnily enough, Tom, when you look on the Consumer Affairs site, it still would say the majority of residents are 55 years or older and retired from full-time employment, you know, which seems to be highly discriminatory about people who may or may not be retired. But that's off their website as at today since you rang me.
Isn't that right?
I'm suggesting that I can go into a village at 55.
But the theory of it is...
Are
you over 55?
Yes.
And retired.
So I made a lot of money on the stock exchange. Mm-hmm. I'm 55 and I can go and move into a retirement village.
And indeed, some villages have that as a condition of their planning permit.
Okay, all right.
And in a modern world, whilst it might have been a good idea 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago when those conditions were applied, it would be interesting to see how that would pass any discrimination test in the modern
now,
world.
Correct. Yes, of course.
You know, because your planning permit is issued at the time of development and never changes.
Mm. Is that likely to get tested in the...
It never has been.
Right.
And but there's probably... Look, we're facing a lot of social change. Grandparents are becoming, you know, major carers
for kids
nowadays, particularly with family breakdown. And some of the challenges we're facing with grandparents is the need to have, you know, children living in a village. And so I think eventually...
Is that possible? It happens?
It does happen, but it's probably more the exception than the rule. Mm-hmm. But the very point that you're making about testing this 55 plus age, and if it ever comes to the situation where it is tested, then I think I'm like Stuart, it would die.
But test for definition of what is retirement. If you're a stockbroker and your life has been investing in the stock market, you retire, move into a retirement village, and continue to play the stock market. Are you working? You know, and so
listen
this whole
to us. Well, know. I was also going to ask because, you know, if you're a couple and only one of you is retired and the other, you know,
is working,
does it still allow for that and that sort of flexibility?
Yeah, some of these arcane rules, you know, really just cease to have any relevance in the modern world.
Particularly as the age is now 65 and getting to 67.
Correct.
Exactly. And certainly most villages would say at the age of 55, we probably don't have the necessary infrastructure to keep you well engaged.
Yeah.
It is more tailored towards people in their, you know, late 60s, early 70s and 80s. I don't know about you're closest, Tom, but, you know, we tend not to cater for people at 55.
We did touch on this last week. Mm-hmm. There are other models of over 55s, and we've heard them advertised, and I'm sure many of our listeners have too. And I think they do cater for a 55 to 75-year-old, but they don't have what the definition is an ingoing contribution, so therefore they're not classed as a retirement village under the Retirement Villages Act. They would fall maybe under a Residential Tenancy Act.
and
so on. So again,
and that's different to a lifestyle village that you mentioned last week as well.
Exactly. So look, we'll explore those as we go down the track. But I think it's interesting that what Stuart's alerted to is that most people that do move into a retirement village are in their, probably, I think the average age is a mid-70s now, and if people are coming in earlier than that, they're usually because of there are health drivers that wanting people to come in. And my personal opinion is, and I think even Peter at the Village Glen, anecdotally, he's getting up to about 79 as the average age.
Our average age at the Village Baxter is 78 people moving in.
Right.
But that varies, of course, a broad spectrum. You know, our youngest person might be 64, and our oldest person moving in might be in their 90s. So consider there's a vast array of different age groups moving into villages, all for different personal reasons. And the thing they all have in common is that they are moving into a state government-regulated retirement village under the Act. May not be perfect, but it is at least some form of protection.
Look, I agree, Stuart. One of the things we wanted to let you guys know, which was different from aged care regulation, which is federal or nationally governed, the Retirement Village Acts are state-based. So there are quite a lot of differences even as you go from state to state.
Right, so Queensland, New South Wales, they're all quite different.
Victoria, in my opinion, is one of the better ones. It's pretty. It's a lot more straightforward, although they're introduced. I've seen Stuart's face.
Everyone's got an opinion.
Everyone's got an opinion. I think that what they're attempting to do is tidy it up. They're trying to make the industry more uniform. One of the things we're going to talk about today is why some of this regulation, some of the disclosures and fact sheets and things you actually have to do is based around people being able to compare accurately apples for apples, because people are not really quite sure what they're actually engaging, whether it's a retirement village, whether it's an aged care, whether it's a land lease type of option.
Right. So how do I go about that?
Okay, well, that's a very good question, because if it's a genuine...
When I'm commended on a good question. Thanks, Tom.
So I'm very impressed. We had impressive last week, but that's good. One of the key
sounds like a yes, Minister. Good question. I'll answer the question I wanted to answer.
That's not true, Biggie.
No, what you see
is what you get. And I do like your jacket, by the way. It looks pretty cool. The question, how do you know what is a retirement village? When you make the call to Stuart and say, I'm looking at the Village Baxter and I want to come here, can you send me some information? Under some regulation and prescribed rules that the Director of Consumer Affairs forces us retirement village operators and owners to do, is we must send you out your pack and your marketing material, but we have to provide you with a fact sheet.
Right, and that's a governance
And that's
type.
A governance thing. It's prescribed in the regulations, and we have to do that. And it outlines lots of different things associated with the management, the ownership, the structure, the planning developments, the entry costs and departure entitlements. So if you receive a package after you've rung up or applied online, it will come with a fact sheet, and that's your first indicator that this is a retirement village under the Retirement Village Act. And what's really important about that is safety and security for most retirees around particularly financial and tenure or security of tenure in a village is based around two important things that occur under the Retirement Village Act. And there has to be a notice put on the title to determine it being a retirement village. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with how the assets are actually apportioned to the residents. And secondary, there has to, under Section 29, there has to be a charge put on that title to secure the financial arrangements. Because most of the time, there is no title tenure, as we've talked about in previous programs. So therefore, this particular notice and charge secures the tenure and the financial contribution that a resident would make to a retirement village.
So what that's effectively saying is that here's my parcel of land. The first people who have claim to that land, should something go wrong, village goes into bankruptcy, are the occupants, are the residents of the village.
All right.
So the sale of a land is there to secure their refunds.
Right.
So that's the purpose as to why it was structured.
That's big.
That's huge.
So there's financial protection there.
There's financial protection because at the end of the day, the best way I describe it, it's like a first mortgage security. If you've had a home and you've had a mortgage, If you can live in the house, do whatever you want to do, you have freedom to come and go, whatever, as long as you pay your mortgage. And in terms of retirement village, as long as you pay your service fees, then one day you go, who's the first person that turns up to get their portion if there's still a mortgage on the property? It's usually the bank.
Yes.
Well, in our cases, our bankers are
the people,
the retirees that,
living
that have put up the ingoing contribution.
Well, I think that puts a great deal of comfort into into the hands of the people that are looking. If I was looking today and I knew that definition protected my mum or my dad, I would feel a lot better having the conversation.
Well, what's interesting and why I grimaced earlier is that the the disclosure statement is 6 pages, 7 pages, whatever it might be. And this concept that you're going to go and visit half a dozen villages and then line up 6 or 7 fact sheets and tick them off page at a time to see where they're different. I mean, that is fanciful at best. You know, no one is going to do that.
No, they're not. But the fact is that it's there. It underpins. There. And I think that...
Oh, but certainly the notice on title has to be there law. Yeah.
Yes.
But, you know, the rest of the stuff that's covered under the disclosure is... You know, so
I think
really
it's
interested.
Protecting the butts of the
proletariat. There's some pretty ugly things in there, you know. Like in reality, in terms of an owner and a developer making sure that they're disclosing and being open and honest and transparent. You know, one of the things that you have to do, for example, you have to indicate to a potential resident if your service fees are running as a shortfall. Quite often in the development stage of a village, when the service fee income from residents is not enough to cover the full provision of services that people are contracting to come and do, that's often picked up by the developer.
Right.
You have to disclose that.
Right.
So once you start providing that information, for example, if there is mortgages on the property from bankers and so on, which obviously fall in terms of behind the statutory requirement of the Retirement Village Act and the charge and so on, you have to disclose that. So people can make an informed decision about a development, a developer, because a lot of that reputational stuff's important for our industry, in my opinion, just because there has been some spectacular failures
in
the
past.
And we don't want to end on that failure, but we do have to end.
We do.
Today,
it's a shame,
for this week.
It?
So we won't get you back next week, but we will have you back next
and
week.
And I might invite Kim back.
Oh, that's a double whammy.
Kim's awesome, mate. She was fantastic last week, wasn't she?
She definitely was.
Yeah, she's... Well, been with me for a long time and knows her stuff.
That says
a lot.
She
definitely does.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for that. A lot of that is dry stuff, but it's very important stuff. And as the stories unfold, then it gets out there and people understand it better. Music?
Oh, music, yes, we do. We're in the 70s again, and we're right back where we started from with Maxine Nightingale.
Lovely.
Back to the age stage. And appropriate song there, Brody, because we have Tricia Hill here from Life Solutions. And thanks for coming back, Tricia.
Hi,
Trish. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you.
Great to be here.
And so Tricia was going to chat to us today a little bit about the difference between an accountant and a financial advisor.
Yes.
The big confusion.
Because we often put them all together. But they're not one and the same.
Well, we do. We make the assumption that at least an accountant can also be a financial advisor, not necessarily the other way around, but we tend to assume that an accountant can be a financial advisor.
And that's true. There are some that are both,
but
they play very different roles.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the difference in if I was looking for an accountant, why would I be going to them versus the financial planner?
An accountant is someone who you go to look for, if you think about help with your taxes and how to minimize the taxes. So we look at sort of our life and we have these different buckets of funds that we have. And so you think about maybe the leaky bucket is the taxes. So the accountant helps you minimize that leak.
Right.
And
right.
We're financial planners, we help you fill the bucket.
Right.
So
we want financial planners to fill
the
bucket.
That's sort of the difference between an accountant. And an accountant looks backwards and looks at the year that was and what kind of taxes do we have and what can we put in place and what can we use to minimize the tax, minimize the leak. And that's very different from a financial planner who people think they don't need a financial planner until they actually have some money. But that's really the opposite because our job is to help you grow and sustain your wealth and then later in life distribute it. So we help you actually fill the buckets. That's our role.
Until you kick the bucket.
Until you kick the bucket. But then we make sure that the when the bucket falls, it goes to the people you want to fill that bucket. We make sure with your lawyer that you get the bucket, the tipping is done right. That's exactly it.
So accountants tend to look back, whereas at any stage in life, then you could look to a financial planner, especially looking towards retirement, but never too early to start filling your bucket.
Never too early to start looking at those different buckets. You've got your, when you're starting out and you want to buy a house and how to actually do that. Secondly, you've got that bucket of the things that you want to fund, your lifestyle. So we look there. And while you're funding your lifestyle and you're in your growth phase, you also have that superannuation bucket that people tend to forget about. And that's your future. That's your retirement. So we help you look at that while your employer or yourself is filling that. How can we actually do the best to fill that bucket? And that's really the difference between a financial planner and an accountant, because we look at how you actually can grow that wealth.
For a small business, this part of the cost of living is often so very hard to meet, isn't it? If you have to put away that money each week into your super,
you've got to be disciplined.
Well, often you don't have it.
Yeah, that's it. And you got to, and that's though where I guess an accountant would come in and say, look, these are the things we actually have to look at, your taxes and putting away super, and what can you do to make sure in that business that you've got, you're doing the very best. And so they would look at that to help you structure that. And then we actually look at what do you do with that money once you have it.
Once you put it away or once you're saving it.
And one of the other differences between an accountant and a financial planner is licensing, and a financial planner is actually license for products. So telling you what and helping you, should you go into shares or should you go into managed funds, should you buy property, things like that. What should you do? What should you do with your superannuation money?
Do they have to declare any interest that they may have in anything that they offer you? So, on a commission basis?
No.
Okay.
So that's all been struck out. So right. It's actually just looking at what, like for a financial planner, they their charge would be based on, it could be an hourly rate or a fee for service.
Right.
This is what we're doing for you and this is what we'll charge.
Right. Okay. So you don't get kickbacks anymore?
No. That's gone.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Well, that's important because, in fact, I've had some financial advice which was very, very poor.
Mm.
And I know it was due to, he was getting huge benefits out of it.
Yeah,
and that was in the early days.
And really, that's why it's all been changed.
Yeah, it's good.
And there's probably a little bit of a hangover from that people aren't aware now that you don't, and it is sort of this unbiased, objective assistance or advice as well.
Mm. Exactly. And I think for the age stage, for those people that are in retirement and looking towards what they need, it's looking about how do we then structure what we've got to meet the needs. And it's lifestyle choices, and sometimes it's looking at, people living in a property and they decide to downsize because they're asset rich and cash poor. How do we change the buckets?
Right.
That kind of thing. Moving into retirement villages, moving into aged care, restructuring the buckets that you've got.
And making sure that you've got something to continue with that lifestyle, whether you end up in a retirement village
exactly.
or you then end up in aged care or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
There's a number of people that have websites that say, we can find your lost super.
Yep.
Are they scams?
I don't know about that. I don't know if they're scams, but I know that you can actually, part of the government website, if you've got your TFN and your birth date, you can go there and they can tell you whether or not there's some superannuation that's out there that you may have had when you had a job and you had a default super like Host Plus or something like that. You might have a little bit left in there if you've paid money in.
But and then, of course, we've always got that problem that you work for a company that hasn't been paying your super, and that's bad news too.
That's bad news.
Yeah.
That's really bad news, and that's where, it's very important to make sure that you are getting that. And
do you have rights as an employee to say?
You do.
Right.
You do. It needs to be paid, and it needs to be paid quarterly. So if it's gone above a couple quarters, you have the right to question that.
And can you do anything about it?
You can. You can actually, I'm not exactly sure where you need to go, but you can go and make sure that you're getting paid.
Right. Okay. Well, that's opened up the at least the foundation to say you're it's not as bad as it was.
No,
it's now on a much stronger footing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
But also it opens up that we do need to plan. We need to think ahead. I know we're always saying, you know, live for today and live in the moment, but if we do too much of that, then we may not be prepared for tomorrow and the next day.
Where can they find you? Where can we find your professional services?
So we're just here in Mornington.
Yep.
And we're at 22A Millgate Drive, just off Tyab Road, yep. Life Solutions. And we're happy to talk to anybody about how we can actually protect
those buckets. Do they need to make an appointment?
Yeah, they can give us a call and make an appointment. Yeah.
Okay, lovely. Well, there you go. We now know where you can go and get some very professional advice.
Yes.
I need some advice on the piece of music you're going to
play. Oh, the piece of music now that we're going to is Love Will Keep Us Together by Brigitte Romanek.
Well, before we do that, we have to play this and then we'll have your music.
Okay. Welcome back. We have Samantha Dickerson with us again this week.
Hi, Sam.
Hello. Thanks for having me again.
Pleasure to have you back.
Myths of cremations.
Yes, and aren't there a lot?
It sounds like something dark and dreary, doesn't it? Myths of cremation.
Well, it's never going to be fun, is it?
No, but, I mean, there are questions that we have to ask. I've probably never really thought about it. It's not something we always have a chat about over the dinner table, is it?
No, it's not. But there's a lot of questions that people have and there's a lot of misconceptions out there as well. So
you can clarify those for us.
That's right.
That's great.
Is it cheaper than burial?
Much cheaper.
Is it?
A prepaid cremation deed can be as cheap as $740 compared to a grave, say, at Springvale Cemetery for $4,500.
Oh, really?
Yes. Big difference, isn't there?
Huge difference.
Is it more sustainable? I know I'm throwing a curly one there, aren't I?
Well, eventually in the next probably 20 years, say for example at Springvale Cemetery, which is on 455 acres, that will be full.
Mm. So right, there won't be any more there's only so much
there.
Land.
So there's only so much land we can have.
Mm.
So in that respect, absolutely.
Yes. Soylent Green. Oh, no, don't go there. So we're going into cremation. Is the casket cremated when you are, or do they just tip you out and?
No, you are cremated in the coffin or casket that you arrive in the cemetery. The only thing that would be removed would be metal handles that may affect the cremation process. So plastic handles remain and are cremated with the coffin or casket.
So
flowers
you can't
are not cremated.
You can't get one that sort of is fake on the inside and you actually can.
So they call it's a terrible term, a rental casket.
Oh, okay.
So the inner shell would be like a chipboard,
yes,
and the outer shell would look like a lovely casket that's removed and taken back to the funeral directors, and the inner casket is then cremated.
That's actually quite a
that
good
makes
idea.
A lot of sense.
It does, and some funeral directors offer that.
Yes.
Not all.
Okay.
Oh, really?
So it's not a common thing.
Oh, okay.
No.
But if they come to you, you would be able to recommend it.
Well, that's right. Absolutely.
That's why you go to a funeral planner in advance.
That's correct.
So you can iron out these
things. Well, that's right. You know, I think there's a lot of things out there, and being an independent funeral planner, I can obviously demystify a lot of things and get people what they actually really want rather than the upsell.
Yes. Well, you're going to be, you know, it's going to be a sooty process, whatever happens.
We needed a pun in there, didn't we?
There's going to be one somewhere.
It's going to be. So, if you can make it more user-friendly by recycling the external packaging, then it makes a lot of sense.
Although, you know, having said that, you know, a plantation particle board coffin is better than, say, your cardboard variety because it creates too much ash. The crematoriums don't particularly like them.
Oh, really?
And they still have to be lined in plastic anyway. So, you know, your plantation pine particle board is just as good.
Right. What happens to jewellery? Do they nick it?
Oh.
When someone passes away, if they have jewellery on, sometimes it can't be removed. Families may say, look, Mum wanted to be cremated with her wedding ring on. Given the temperature of the cremators, any material is fused together. It's no longer valuable or of any sort.
So it just turns into a blob, does it?
Yeah.
I suppose that's the fillings of your teeth. And
well, anything like that. I mean, you know, we're talking about temperatures of between 800 and 1,000 degrees centigrade.
Okay. It's hot, isn't
it? That's pretty hot.
Mm. Mm.
And so if you have metal bits, like
a
hip replacement?
So if you've got an artificial hip, that will still be there. That is removed prior to the bones being what we call pulverized in a cremulator. So those metal fragments are removed, and traditionally they're taken away and buried within the cemetery grounds.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Some families ask for them back. I'll have Dad's hip back. Some of the religions actually come and pick over the bones and take right. out little bits and pieces.
But that's part of the religion, is it?
That's part of the religious
requirement.
Yeah, requirements
part
for some
of their faith.
Yeah, for yeah. some faiths.
Is anything removed? And it's getting gruesome, isn't it? But it's an important conversation. Is anything removed prior to cremation? Does everything have to be removed?
You have to have a pacemaker removed. So part of the application for cremation form asks whether or not the deceased had a pacemaker. If they do have one, that is removed prior to the cremation, normally within the mortuary, because they can explode in a cremator. So they must be removed.
Right.
And yeah. that's performed by the
embalmer.
The embalmer, right. Mm. Okay. The embalmer is the person who prepares the body.
That's right. Yeah. So the embalming process is when bodily fluids are replaced with embalming fluid.
Right. Okay. Does that happen to everybody?
No. Oh. You don't have to have that done at all.
Right.
You know, certainly if someone is going to be viewed, then embalming is done as a means of preservation of the deceased, presentation, sanitation.
Yep.
So that way they
what
look
What would be the percentage then roughly of people who do have an open casket versus a closed?
Look, it really depends on some religions will have an open coffin or casket. And it also depends on
the
family. State of the deceased.
Oh,
and
of course,
that
yes.
sort of thing. A lot of people, if it's a sudden death, may require that sense of closure by actually seeing them again.
Yes.
They don't have to be viewed, but for a lot of people, as I said, it is a sense of closure to see them again, just to say their final farewells.
Say final goodbye.
Put some photos or letters in with them, that sort of thing.
Where can you scatter remains?
Well, I always say to people, please be discreet about it, because it's not like the movies. It's not like talcum powder that you see in Meet the Fockers or anything like that. It's not how it happens. It's far more granular. You need to be quite discreet when you scatter cremated remains. You know, down here, particularly on the peninsula, people like to scatter in the water.
Oh, down by the bay?
By the bay.
Which is a beautiful setting.
Yeah. You know, you don't want to be scattering into the wind.
Right.
So there are options for a far more dignified way of doing that with a biodegradable urn that looks a bit like paper mache. You can throw it onto the water, it'll sit for a few minutes, then it sinks to the bottom and the entire urn is biodegradable.
Oh,
so
right.
So that's a nice way of doing it.
That's actually a lovely way.
Yeah, much more dignified than trying to open the moulded plastic urn that comes from the crematorium, which has a very firm plug in the top, and unless you've got a handy screwdriver with you, you won't get it open. So it's a much more dignified way of doing it.
You could make it boat-shaped and sort of push it off.
Well, you could.
Like a Viking.
There's an idea.
We need ideas because people end up with cupboardfuls of grannies.
Well, they do. They do.
And grandpa.
And another interesting option is, of course, that you can turn a portion of cremated remains into a diamond.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, so the carbon.
They use the carbon.
The carbon's extracted from the cremated remains. You only need about a cup. And you can have a diamond made. It takes about, say, roughly 12 months, and depending on the size of the diamond that you wish to have, let's say between half a carat and 0.6 of a carat can be upwards of $10,000 Australian.
Ouch.
Wow.
But it's a very unique and discreet way of remembering someone.
It's actually a beautiful way to remember your loved one.
It is a beautiful way of doing it. Absolutely.
And then that can be passed on again as well.
Well, absolutely. Yes, it can be. Bit tricky, isn't it? Would you like to have grandpa?
Well, it could be the eternity ring that you always wanted, but
well, that's
got.
True. That's true.
Well,
when my father died, my wife brought his ashes back because he liked it here, and so part of his ashes.
Mm.
And I cast a rock and mixed his ashes and made a special formula that I developed. Made literally his ashes into a rock, and we had a ceremony down on the beach. And you'd never have picked it. You can't.
It looks like
just
another
like
rock.
It looks like a lovely rock.
And we've placed it in a spot, and he now has lodgers. That he has winkles.
Oh, really?
He does. Yes.
Oh, how lovely!
So he sits there quietly, and I know exactly.
So
where
he's
he is.
Just part of the bay.
Yeah,
part of
no one would know.
No one would ever know, which is a lovely thing. That's, and I think there's got to be, there are lots of people that say, oh, mum and dad are in the cupboard at home.
Mm.
You know, you have the option of memorialising in a cemetery if you wish, but I don't think many people tend to visit cemeteries to remember and visit cremation memorials.
Well, I've done it for a few people now because it's sort of just they asked me to do it.
Absolutely.
That's been fantastic. Thank you, Sam.
That's all right. My pleasure.
Really, really interesting. I was going to say, what would you like to have a piece of music, but I'm afraid it's not your choice.
That's okay.
And we'll see you again in a couple of weeks, I hope.
I'd love
back
to come
Samantha.
Back. Love
Thank
to come
you.
Back. Thank you.
Thank you.
And don't forget, where can people contact you, Sam, if they want to get some further advice?
At this stage through the station, but I'm working on my website, so as soon as that's up and running, you'll be the first to know, and people can ask me anything they
want. So just, if you want to find out anything from Sam, please leave your questions at the station, and we'll make sure that she gets them, won't we?
Yes, we will. We'll pass them on.
Right. Well, it moves on. We need a last bit of music.
Our last song for today. Well, it's the afternoon, so Starland Vocal Band.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of my favourites from the 70s, Afternoon Delight.
And Mr. Adam Ford, welcome to the show. How are you, young man? Welcome to the show.
Hi, Adam.
Vicky can hear me talking to you, so that's the main thing. But I'll handle the predominant part of the questions. Now, first of all, today we're going to be looking at river cruising because it seems to suit older people. Is that where we're coming?
It is incredibly popular, particularly with older Australians. I think, you know, as you enter retirement, you're really looking for that sort of that world trip. Then European river cruising really fits that mould, and it's just taken off like a house on fire. There are so many Aussies heading over to Europe to do really what is, you know, these days the modern grand tour of old world Europe, and it's just a fabulous experience.
The river cruising themselves have the owners, quite a lot of them are Australian, aren't they?
They are, yeah. There's some big Australian companies that are involved in European river cruising. You've got APT, you've got Scenic Tours, Nevergreen Tours, a whole bunch that have really, you know, invested in this segment of the leisure cruising market, and it's really paid off for them because, as I say, it's incredibly popular. There are lots of companies offering European river cruising, and there are lots of different permutations of the theme. So there are different routes, different rivers that you can take on, and different countries that you can visit, and short cruises and long cruises. Most people tend to go with the 14-day version, which runs in either direction from Amsterdam through to Budapest on the Rhine and the Danube rivers, or in the reverse order, so from Budapest back up to Amsterdam. There are French river cruises you can do as well, but that 14-day Amsterdam to Budapest tends to be the sort of the main itinerary that most people go for.
What's the great draw card with river cruising?
Look, I think that one of the biggest draw cards is you get to see a lot of Europe with very little effort, if you like. So, of course, you know, lots of people love to do tours around Europe, bus tours and that sort of thing, but it can be fairly arduous, particularly if you're on the move day after day. You know, you're in different hotels, packing and unpacking and so on. The beauty of river cruising is, of course, that you get to unpack once and then you just drift through old world Europe, which, you know, a fantastic way to travel, I've got to say.
It'd be a very relaxing way to travel, wouldn't it, Adam?
Oh, I can hear you, Vicky.
Yes, you can, Adam. I can hear you.
Beautiful. We've fixed it.
Yeah, it's a very relaxing way to travel. And as I say, you get to unpack once, beginning, you know, 14 days on the river. You're just in such a relaxed state by the time you reach the other end. And, of course, you know, you can start off with a couple of nights in Amsterdam if you want to and end with a couple of extra nights in Budapest. The sky's the limit depending on what you want to pay. But for most people, that 14-day itinerary, Amsterdam to Budapest, is really what most people go for.
And, of course, you only unpack once, don't you? Which is the
yeah,
job.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really the
secret. Once, yeah. The other great thing about it, of course, is all your meals are included. So, you know, that's a big draw for people, particularly when you're not putting your hand in your pocket every 5 minutes to pay for something when you're on perhaps on a tour where all meals aren't included. On a European river cruise, breakfast, lunch and dinner are included, as are most of your drinks. So, you know,
oh, really?
Drinks with you. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, Brody's eyes just lit up.
Yeah, exciting.
I could soon put a stop to
drinks
that.
With your main meals are generally included. Pretty much always included. Some tours include things like specialty coffees and that sort of thing. There's generally tea and coffee available as part of the package, but if you're after specialty coffees, some cruises include them, some you have to pay a bit extra for those. There's bar facilities, obviously, for after dinner and that sort of thing, and you do pay for those extra drinks, but with your lunch and your dinner, and I've even seen it with breakfast, you get red and white wine, sparkling beer and that sort of stuff.
Mm. Do they move at night? Is that how it works? And then you get
yeah,
off?
Yeah, they do move at night. So essentially what happens is you wake up each morning, you look out your window and you're in a brand new place. And it's just, it's really, really magical, I have to say. I can't tell you how special that those towns and cities along the Danube are. They're incredibly historic. I mean, they all date back to, you know, the 11th, 12th century, and it's, you know, grown over the years from there. But you sail through gorgeous wine-producing regions like the Wachau Valley, which my pronunciation is probably pretty bad, but that's what I was told it is. But beautiful wine-producing regions. You've got old-world cities like Vienna, for example. That's a massive highlight of any European river cruise. And generally, you'll get to spend sort of two nights in Vienna. Mm-hmm. The great thing is the cruises dock pretty close to the centre of these towns as well. So in many cases, you can walk into the centre of town.
So you have the freedom to do what you want during the day, or they have tours as well during the day for you?
Yeah, no. And you can go off on your own and do your own thing. You just, I mean, obviously, if the ship's moving on, you need to make sure you're back in plenty of time. But that's a golden rule for any cruise. Mm-hmm. But generally, they will provide a shore excursion as part of the package as well. So there'll always be some organised excursion that is included. And that might be a guided walk around, you know, a city like or around the Milk Abbey, for example, or perhaps a walk around a beautiful town called Dürnstein, a guided walking tour. There are optional extra tours, of course, that you can spend more money on and sort of head off and do your own thing. Again, the sky's the limit. There's a whole range of stuff on offer. But there'll always be at least one included excursion, and then you can, of course, do your own thing.
Fantastic.
How many people would they have on board?
Yeah, so that's another real you know, draw card for a lot of people, because the cruises are not overpowering. So you're looking at most of them take around the 120 to 140 mark.
Oh, that's,
you know, that's
big,
not too many
difference
people
to a major cruise.
Yes, you might even get to know all of them.
Well, that's the thing. You can quite possibly get to know a lot of people on that. And, you know, you can move around at night and have dinner with different groups and that sort of thing. So you'll get to know as many of your fellow passengers, you know, as well as you want to. And if you want to do your own thing and you don't want to mingle, that's fine. There are smaller tables for dinner and that sort of stuff. So it's very relaxed. I found it really sort of, everyone was in a great frame of mind. You know, it's a beautiful setting. People are talkative and chatty, and you can get to know pretty much everybody.
Is the food up to, you know, really high class? Is it a good, or is it snack food or?
No, not at all. No, not at all. All of your meals will be... Look, I haven't heard of a European river cruise company that doesn't offer a pretty extensive menu. You're talking generally a buffet for lunch, that sort of hot and cold buffet style of lunch. But then, you know, it's a beautiful three-course dinner, four courses in some cases, beautiful presentation, and also a real emphasis on local specialties. A lot of cruise companies sell their menu on that basis. So, you know, when you're passing through Hungary, for example, you'll try some goulash. When you're in, you know, Austria, you might try Vienna Schnitzel and all those sorts of things. So it's a real sort of local specialty kind of feel to the menu. It changes all the time. The cruise that I did was absolutely amazing. I couldn't get over the variety of the food, to be honest. It was fantastic. So, yeah, big variety, big emphasis on local specialties, and also local wine, as I mentioned earlier.
Best time to travel?
Look, best time to travel. European river cruising is generally cheaper at either end of the season. So, the earlier you go in spring and the later you sort of go in autumn, you will do better in terms of price. I personally love Europe on the shoulder season. So yes, I really love
I'm
it
with you.
Sort of early May. Mm. Yeah, it's just a beautiful time.
I like the other end. I like September.
Yeah,
well,
look, they've both got their strengths, but it's a great time to travel. Prices are lower. Crowds are generally less. And the weather is really sort of temperate. You know, it's not too hot, it's not too cold. It's just really, really pleasant. And, of course, it's spring in early May, sort of June. You've got flowers in bloom, all that sort of thing. At the other end, you know, your choice. You've got beautiful autumn colours. So, for me, shoulder season is a great value in Europe and a really top time to travel.
Adam, it's been fantastic. We love your advice. Where can people come to it to get more information about your service offering?
Yes, they can jump on our website, thebigbus.com. www.cruisingnews.com.au. We do have a couple of European river cruising stories on there. There's some great tips on booking a European river cruise, what to look for. My big piece of advice there, when you're looking, when you're considering a European river cruise, start early. You want to be looking, you know, a year and a half out from when you actually want to travel. Make contact with companies, get on their mailing list, look out for specials, really do your research, and just take some time, because it's a big investment and you really want to get the best possible deal for what, you know, the money you want to spend.
You don't get better advice than that. Thanks, buddy. I really appreciate it. It's great to have you on the show, and we'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks.
My pleasure, guys. Happy travels.
All right, mate. Take care.
Thanks, Adam.
Well, the end of another show.
Another show down.
That was a great show.
Oh, it was a great show. It's always a great show. I mean, Samantha is very interesting. I mean, I've learned so much about cremation and such that questions that you don't usually ask.
It's nice to be able to have the conversation without it being a little bit difficult, isn't it?
Difficult or morbid.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
That's right. And Tricia enlightened us with knowing the difference between an accountant and a financial planner.
Absolutely. And that's a mistake I probably made one too often.
I think we probably all made that mistake.
I have to say, I'm green with envy about the idea of going away on that.
A river cruise. Doesn't it sound just magic?
It does. So I guess the real issue is sort of, what's next week?
Because next week? Well, next week we'll have
everyone here, haven't we?
We'll have Legal Eagle Andrea Staunton. I hope she doesn't mind us calling her that, but she is very knowledgeable in that area.
Is she?
Stuart and Kim back talking about retirement life.
Yep.
And
because Tom's away, isn't he?
Tom is away. I don't know where he's going, but he's on holiday or something. And Noel will be here talking things automotive, cars, that sort of thing.
Yep.
And possibly Damien to
doing health.
Health, yes. Yeah. Always.
We always find it up a bit later in the week, don't we?
We do. But it's been a pleasure.
It's been great fun.
Okay.
Until next week then.